Welcome back to Conspiracy Worldwide Radio, Mr. Saul Williams. How are you this fine evening?
I'm great, man. How are you?
Yeah, we're doing well. We're doing very well tonight. Now, of course, it's all about the brand new album. Since we last spoke on this show, this is, I think, is the first full release from yourself, Volcanic Sunlight. What an epic and powerful title to begin with.
Thank you, man. Really, the title just came to me when I was needed to create a name to store the file, the first file for the album, and I stuck with it.
And it is an amazing time to put this out there, because I feel that that really is a summary of the way society is at the moment. There is so much anger in the air throughout the world, and there has been for months now. It seems as if there's been a shift. I think that's the word. There's been a shift.
Well, I feel like the shift has been going on for some time. And yeah, Volcanic Sunlight alludes to the idea of the rise of the underground. And it's true that, you know, the underbelly of modern-day society is filled with people who imagine a world that that is just, and where people can experience things like education and just simple things like food, shelter, and health, you know, with the help of their governments, and not see their governments philandering money, you know, to banks and corporations and what have you, and see them, you know, looking out for their citizens. And in that sense, yeah, there is a rise, I guess, or a shift in consciousness where more people see it more readily, and because of technology and the internet, we're able to connect on those ideas. And supposedly reality, you know, is based upon agreement. And if we all agree on that, then we can shift reality.
I had heard recently in an interview by you, you had discussed the different disciplines between performing as an artist and performing as an actor. And I was surprised by what you had said, particularly about acting being an unselfish medium to invest in. I mean, can you elaborate on exactly what it was you meant by that?
Surely. You know, when I speak of acting, I'm not speaking of the sort of amenities that might come from acting in, you know, modern day society where celebrity, you know, is rewarded with finance and all this type of stuff. I'm talking about the actual experience of lending your voice to another idea, to the experience of embodying the idea of another character and imagining, in fact, empathizing with you know, how a certain character might feel in a given situation that you may not have felt ever in your personal life, but you try to find a way to relate to. You know, that's the role of the actor, and that's why acting can be, you know, a magical experience for those who are, you know, on stage performing, you know, losing themselves, finding themselves, because, you know, on a bad day, in a play, for example, in theater, you know, you may be on stage thinking about, oh, I need to pay my phone bill, or, oh, I need to call my girlfriend, or why didn't my girlfriend call me? But on a great day, you know, as soon as you step out on stage playing this other character, you have lost every outside connection with the world, and you are completely committed to this idea and to this story. And that's a particular experience, you know. It's like being a vessel. It feels wonderful. It's like being on stage singing. It feels wonderful, and it feels bigger than you itself. So that's what I'm speaking to, not to, you know, the idea of earning $20 million for a movie.
Right. Now, speaking of vessel, you mentioned the term vessel there. The name of this new album is, of course, called Volcanic Sunlight, with the concept being that the sun and God is this force outside, a force that shines down on you, almost as if this God comes from within yourself and pulls you out and shares this element with everyone. This is perhaps your most unselfish album yet, which is why I mentioned the question just earlier with regards to selfishness. But with regards to this inner God and this concept, I'm curious as to what extent you were inspired by the 5% Nation to manifest this idea.
Well, to be honest, you know, the 5% Nation is not something I really think about too much, aside from like reciting rap lyrics every now and then. You know, I can't say that I think about them any more than I think about, you know, Buddhists or Hindus or Baha'i faith people. You know, like, I can't say that religion itself played a strong effect on what I was thinking about when I thought of volcanic sunlight. I thought more so of essentially of, like you said, although I, you know, I can choose randomly whether to place the idea or concept of God on top of it or not, but the idea of this light that comes from within instead of above. Thus, you know, it's this thing, this power from within that you, yeah, that blossoms and that you grow to share. And yeah, that's important to me. But the idea of, you know, I can't say that I really thought about 5 percenters or what have you. But yeah, I grew up around a lot of 5 percenters and hip hop is full of, you know, a lot of, especially hip hop from the '80s and nineties is full of a lot like Wu-Tang and what have you. And the references are very interesting oftentimes. And more than interesting, important, true, but yeah, I wasn't thinking about that. That's kind of my style. I try not to think about anything and then write and then make the connections after, like, oh, you know, like I try to, I guess, to kind of fish with my eyes closed and then see what I pull up. But yeah, all the layers of, and depths may push through things that I'm familiar with or what have you. So there may be an influence, but it's not premeditated.
It's interesting. You gave that response just a few seconds ago about, you know, the way you create music, because I was saying this is a very humanist album, you know, that kind of introspective aspect of the whole product at the end. But what I was going to ask you about is that something you consciously do, and what you've just said there is no. I mean, how did you create this album? What a massive question and what a broad question. But how did you go about making this? Was it just a spontaneous thing, a series of spontaneous things, or do you put hours and hours of thought into, you know, each concept throughout the album?
It's a series of spontaneous things followed by hours and hours of thought and actions, which really is like just dancing. It started with the music first, and in the most straightforward answer I can give you, like, I programmed beats. You know, I sat at my, or stood at my keyboard and played, you know, whether horn sounds or guitar sounds and programmed drums and what have you, and I came up with beats. And so before I had, you know, like the idea of the song Patience, I had the music for the song Patience, and once I heard the music, I tried to find the place to put my voice, and that matched, you know, I tried to find the words and ideas that matched the sentiment of the music. There was a certain sound that I was looking for, essentially found through a lot of like tribal rhythms and classical horns. And I was interested in the combination of the two. And so there's a lot of long horn, you know, parts where it's just like, oh, with crazy, you know, drums. And so just playing with the contrast of that. And so from that came the inspiration to put my voice, however I did, and to say whatever I said in those moments. But yeah, it's spontaneous when it happens. You know, it's not some premeditated, I'm going to do this. It's more like, oh, wow, this absinthe is really good. I think I'm going to turn my computer on. It's more like that.
Would you say that this new project is the closest project representative of your truest self?
Yeah, I would say that. I mean, if you ask me that for any album, I would have the same answer, to be honest. You know? But yes, I feel that even more this time around. Yeah, I feel it with greater depth, and I feel like that's, it's the most fully rounded perspective of me, or sharing from me. You know, like I think I see a few elements of my sense of humor, a few elements of what's important to me, a few elements of my, you know, romantic perspective of life and love and all of these things. And my passion for humanity and change and all of these things. I see a lot of myself in there.
That's interesting. I mean, what I will say about this project is that it's perhaps some of your if not your most calculated work to date. I mean, having exercised a lot of anger and frustrations in your material prior, would you say that this album is a celebration of letting go and embracing a frustrated side of yourself that's now decaying? You're letting go of this decaying side of yourself with these frustrations. You're celebrating life now. You found your niche as an artist. You found your niche as a man, but you found your niche in your own skin.
Thank you. That's exactly what I would say. Thanks for saying it for me.
Okay. I mean, do you want to expand on that, Saul? Do you want to expand on that?
Well, you know, I mean, I can just for the fun of it, but yeah, that's really exactly what the experience was. It's exactly what it was. You're right on.
Okay, excellent. Now, bringing it back to what we were talking about earlier with regards to selfishness, I think that essentially our conscience is the measure of the honesty of our selfishness, and as humans, we seem to have this tendency to overlook it. I mean, do you ever struggle as an artist listening to that conscience and exercising that balance?
Yeah, I do. You know, the thing is, you know, just to put it, I guess, in more practical terms for myself would be that, you know, for instance, it's like, I believe that this album contains a song that I might actually sing to my girlfriend. You know, whereas on other albums, you'd hear stuff that I would, you know, say in the name of Che Guevara or say to George Bush or Dick Cheney if I ever saw him in his face. You know, like they were broader ideas, and I was taking broader strokes. And yes, you know, it was very calculated in a sense, and I was playing with being clever and all of this stuff. Where this is a much simpler side where there's nothing to prove. And I think that's part of what the experience of this album was for me too, is that I felt as if I really had nothing to prove. And yeah, that's a culmination of maturity and a culmination of feeling good about what I've done in the past. You know, I feel good about the things that I've said and Mickey Tardust and previous albums. And I feel like, okay, I've let that out. Now, yeah, I think it is a matter of exercising something that may be more personal or more difficult. Not to say that the other stuff wasn't difficult. There are moments of difficulty all the time, and there are moments when I contemplate whether I should share, you know, what I've written. And that didn't just happen on this album. That happened a lot on Nicki Tardust, actually, and before that on other albums too, where I was like, oh boy, is this right? Should I share this? But this time around, the question, if there wasn't a question of sharing, I wanted to share, you know, the most intimate aspects. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You mentioned some difficulties you've overcome in the past. What specific difficulties are you actually referring to there?
They usually have to do with timidity in some way, shape, or form, you know, or insecurity in some way, shape, or form, you know. Like, the first difficulty I had to approach as an artist was that, you know, I never felt like I had the right to sing, you know, but I knew if I was making an album that I would want to listen to, there would need to be some singing on it. You know, like a lot of people would say, oh, when are you going to make, you know, a more straight ahead hip hop album? But I started rap when I was like 8 or 9, you know, and I started like recording albums, you know, around the age of 25. And so like, I was rapping for a long time. I get bored with just rapping, you know? Yeah. And so, yeah, it was difficulty, like, over the years. Like, I think Nicki Tardust, for example, was my first courageous moment in feeling like, okay, I'm going to sing. So that was one of the difficulties. And then there's questions about, you know, how powerful something is. Like, I remember when I recorded the song Trigger off of Nicki Tardust and feeling like, can I say this? Should I say this? Because I'm very aware of the fact that people are going to sing along. Do I want to put these words in other people's mouths? in everybody's mouth. You know, like, what's even the name of that album? There were a lot of questions. I faced a lot of fears on that album that I released, and that's why Volcanic Sunlight is so free.
This is really interesting, Saul. As I remember, the last time you came on a show, we were talking about Kanye West and his album 808s and Heartbreaks, and we had this conversation. We were talking about artists who now sin, who aren't, you know, afraid to be creative beyond the rapping. And I think what your album did with Trent, what that album did was really channel conventional hip hop artists to sin and be more creative beyond rapping. Now, I think, when we trace back to your work prior to Volcanic Sunlight, be it your work in music, writing, or acting, the foundation of his creation always goes back to your interest in relationships and music, which, you know, essentially would manifest as becoming this music of relationships. You've never considered yourself as a poet. Would you consider yourself as a bedroom philosopher?
I think that's exactly what I am. I think that's exactly what I am. You know, once again, you're dead on. Yes, that is exactly. I feel comfortable with considering myself that. Okay. I'm a bedroom philosopher. Why
bedroom
not?
Philosopher slash MC.
Sounds like a new Cool Keith album. That title. I like it.
That's perfect.
Now, if we're talking about relationships, music relationships, personal relationships, what would you say was the biggest difference between yourself composing alone in isolation and yourself, you know, exercising this creativity on the road performing with a live band?
Well, I tell you, you know, I think the it's kind of like engineering. At first, it's like for instance, with this album, I think I laid down in my demos, I feel like I laid down the most accurate sketches of ideas that I've ever laid down. They were really accurate, you know, so that the album sounds a lot like the demos, but fleshed out with real instruments as opposed to me just programming them, you know? Mm-hmm. And then going on stage with real musicians, so I don't consider myself a real musician. Like, I know how to achieve a sound or an idea that I may have in my head. I know how to do that with an instrument. And because of recording devices, you know, I only have to do it once or twice before it's recorded and I can lay it down, you know, but to be able to, like, execute that on a regular basis, the only thing I can do that with is my voice.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? You know, maybe with the drum. You know, and I really felt like I laid down accurate sketches, and the musicians have responded. The musicians I've been working with, as I've been touring, starting in Europe with this album, we've really bonded over the music. Like, they are excited to play it, and me, I'm excited to hear it coming from them. Mm. And of course, because of their own, you know, beings and who they are, there are variations that occur, but they're in the spirit of the music in such a way that it has all, like, correlated wonderfully. Performing is a gift. Performing is the only thing better than headphones, you know, like when you're walking down the street and the vibe is right and the sun is out and you have on headphones and everything is like the most perfect music video. I used to have I remember when I was living in New York, I made a tape. This is way back. This is like with Walkmans. I made a tape a mixtape of songs with like Nina Simone and Hendrix and Fela and all this stuff just from getting to my house to the subway. You know, and some days it would be perfect, like, wow, you know, the perfect song would start right when the subway door closed, you know, and then, you know, everything would change with this song. I think that performing is the only thing that tops that, you know, it allows me to actually live the songs. And it's amazing. But creating is an exciting process too. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of repetition in that. You know, like, I have to listen to something 100 times sometimes before I can figure out the next thing that comes. But I'm enjoying it. You know, like, it's yeah, there's a lot of fun energy in the creative process. Mm. But yeah, on stage it takes it to a new level, because then I'm really, really freed up, because now I don't have to use my hands and my mind to create the music. So now I can just really dance and allow my voice to dance as well. And it's a gift, truly. Yeah. I really enjoy it. It's something I truly enjoy.
Well, we can only imagine, I mean, what that energy and that feeling must be like. And speaking of dancing and energy, I know the press release at least says this, that this new album, Volcanic Sunlight, is the brightest, most rhythmic and danceable opus yet that you've released. Now, in these modern times, that word danceable doesn't sit that comfortably sometimes with hip-hop. And I just wondered, how do you view this album in terms of not just being something that people can consciously absorb, to stimulate thought, to make people agree and get that cohesion between people, but also as something that people can now just genuinely enjoy themselves too? Where does this album sit in your catalogue when it comes to that kind of just pure energy and that pure vibe of the dance?
That's all I wanted to deliver. Like, for me, it's funny because, you know, I get a lot of conversations, get into a lot of conversations about poetry and words. But when it comes to music, for me, the first thing that's important to me is dancing, which means that I can listen to a lot of songs with stupid lyrics if the beat and the voice and all that is right. You know, and I'd rather listen to that song than to a song with great lyrics and a great meaning and a real boring placement of drums and voice and rhythms. If it doesn't move me, I don't care how positive it is sometimes, you know. I'm really into dancing is what I'm trying to say. And most of my choices, even of words, have to do with the danceability that comes when they come through my mouth. You know, like, I don't want it to get in the way. It has, you know, I think I've always felt that way, but I haven't always been as at the point where I am now in trying to execute that, you know. In the past, I really felt like, but I have to say this, I have to say this, you know? And I listened back to some of my old albums, and I'm like, damn, I'm talking a lot, you know? And with Volcanic Sunlight, I really didn't want to get into the way of the music, you know? I didn't want words to get into the way, and so that the music could overpower it, so that the poetry could reside simply within the music, and that's not really simple. Mm-hmm. And yeah, dancing is important. So I think that this album does that pretty well, because it's really an exploration of polyrhythm. You know, that's what it became. That's probably the difference between the demos and the actual recording, is that we started adding so much percussion that it really became way more polyrhythmic. Robert's at first just trying to achieve that with my voice. But in terms of danceability, also, I have to admit that I was thinking about the same thing when I was making the Guitar Dust and every other album. Like, for me, it's the beat that inspires the words. If someone wants to applaud me for thinking different, I would point to the beats and say, nah, it's that. You know, if you nod your head differently, that's going to affect how you think, yeah. You know? And that's what I'm getting off on. Like, the title song of the album, Volcanic Sunlight, is the most fun to perform because of the way that I have to dip and dive in between the beats in order to be on beat. It's like an obstacle course, and it feels so fun.
How much did your relocation then, and actually moving out to Paris and living there? You mentioned there about actually making music videos, the perfect soundtrack on the headphones, and that was New York. But what about when you come to Paris then? I mean, what type of influence has that had, not only on how you're living every day and the culture that is in Paris, but also your creative culture now when you're making music?
I think the influence was really subtle but wonderful, you know, like, the thing about, you know, great taste in art, I think, and I think Paris is a great example of that, is in its subtlety, oftentimes. You know, oftentimes, not always. And, you know, I came here with my demos already written, with them already done. So I came here strictly to record. But the vibe of yeah, I think I may have been a bit more relaxed and excited to be in a foreign environment. You know, I definitely found myself visiting museums and galleries more and approaching the lifestyle here, which is a bit different from in the U.S. because in the U.S., you know, we're pretty prone to work day and night, you know, nonstop. It's dog eat dog, you know, go for it. Go for what you know. You better get your grind on in the States. And here it's like, okay, 6 o'clock, time for me to be with my girl, with my family. We're not talking about work again until, you know, 9 or 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. You know, like it's a real schedule and balance between like work life and life away from work. You know, it's basically ambition does not rule the day. It can rule the work hours, you know, but it's but when it's time to enjoy life and family and fun and friends, that time comes too. And so I slowly, you know, shifted my work ethic. I still work in the middle of the night making music and writing and what have you, but I found myself taking more time to just kind of chill. Not that I didn't do that before, but it was interesting to experience that in a culture. And I think the amount of time that I spent chilling with music, I mean, I was in the studio for a year, which was another gift being here in Paris. You know, there's some old school things that prevail here, such as the fact that I could be in the studio for a year. Like, wow. I worked out on that home and finished my demos and then went into the studio with musicians and all that for a year. Every day, going in, listening, you know, and then stopping at 8 o'clock. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow at 1, you know. And, wow, yeah, that had some kind of effect. I don't know what it was, but it put it in a nice, just context. It felt wonderful. The working hours, I don't know, maybe it had something to do with socialism.
Right. No, speaking of socialism, absolutely. You now exposed to this newfound lane of creativity that you didn't have the privilege of knowing out there in the States. You now have this new lane of creativity that you're able to exercise your artistry in today, you know? It's a whole new ball game for you. Now, you mentioned socialism. You mentioned the beat-inspiring words just moments ago, but to what extent would you say Paris, being a city renowned for romance, has evoked any kind of inspiration and saw the bedroom philosopher in his lyricism on this album?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, it's. I think it's really important. It's been important for me as an American to step outside of America in order to gain broader perspective, you know? It's kind of like, for instance, you know, where it's like you think of the Occupy movement, you know? Mm. And it's and that, I think, is a wonderful example, not for what it stands for, but the subtle nuances of what it stands for. Because when I think of the Occupy movement, the first thing I think of is what happened in Egypt and Tunisia, and is happening in Syria and Yemen and Israel and Palestine. I think of the Arab Spring, you know, Libya. I think of the Arab Spring. And here we have this Arab Spring and this rush of awareness and a desire for change that, you know, that starts in the Middle East and pushes outward. And when it reaches America, it finds the perfect branding name, Occupy. Right? Now, the beauty of that, is all the kids in the street in America, because I tell you, being in Europe, it's great to see how Europeans and, you know, Middle Easterners, Africans are inspired by seeing people protesting in America. Because American protest has inspired the protest, not government, the protest against it, the civil rights movement and what have you. That type of thing has inspired people globally, right? And so when people go out into the streets in that place and say, yeah, this is supposed to be the land of the free, but wait a minute, what about this? What about that? That can be a little inspiring because it touches on the pulse of, you know, the global culture itself, you know? And, but what it also does through the branding process is sometimes it makes you forget the thing that came before it, the root of it, especially when that root is brown and buried beneath history and all these things. Once again, we're alluding to this Arab Spring, which is really what Occupy is a response to. You know, it's a continuation of. So anyway, I think that, gosh, I'm trying to remember your question. What was your question, dude?
It's fine. I was just talking about Paris being a city.
I was saying that, Paris being the city. Go ahead. Tell me the full question, because I've just blanked fully on this.
It's cool. You're doing a good job, so you're doing a good job. basically, my question was, we were talking about how the beat inspires your lyricism earlier, and I was just wondering how Paris being a city renowned for its romance inspires Saw the Bedroom Philosopher to write. How did it inspire for you to write your Saw the Bedroom Philosopher on this album, basically?
Exactly. So what I was saying in this elaborate response was essentially that stepping outside of America allowed me to look at things from a perspective that I may not have seen from the inside of America. From the inside of America, I may have had the illusion that, it starts with Occupy, 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 Occupy. But I'm able to experience reality from a more global perspective. Because I do feel like the global character of Paris, I don't think of Paris as a city that really belongs. Yes, of course, it belongs to France, but I think of it as a city that belongs to the world itself. So many people meet here, as they do in New York, but New York is embedded in this, you know, American, you know, reality, where Paris itself, I don't see it as embedded with simply the reality. Well, maybe the reality of France is this thing that allows these other things in and out, but although Algerians may differ on that opinion. Either way, I think that being here has certainly opened me. And I'd be a fool to say that had no influence on, you know, the finishing touches that I placed on this album while living here. You know, I also travel a lot. So I'm not only living here, but I mean, like, part of my reason for allowing myself to relocate to Paris was because I'd always received invitations to do stuff in Europe and Africa and the Middle East. Sometimes, but it would be like for a day, and I'm like, do I want to fly from New York to California to this place for a day and nothing to do after? Living in Paris has allowed me to say yes to a lot of those opportunities. So, for example, right before I started recording this album, I made a trip to Israel and Palestine. And I finished writing the song Explain My Heart while I was there. The influence of being here, but also the influence of being able to jump and bounce to so many other places certainly is inspiring and has its effect on how I think and how I see myself and how I see, you know, my work, et cetera.
I can only imagine. I mean, it's the element of culture. It's the element of absorbing, like you just said there, absorbing all the different cultures, the different beliefs, the different boundaries as well. Let's not forget the boundaries in societies that you would have seen in the different countries that you went to there. Where do you see this going? Now, Saul Williams is the philosopher, the bedroom philosopher. We've coined that phrase a few times now. But what about Saul Williams as the kind of the sage, the kind of prophet who looks forward? Where do you see all this protest, if we want to use the word the media are using, around the world? Where do you see it ending? Where does it all go now? Is it just going to peter out, or is there going to be a change?
Well, you know, I think that that things come in cycles, in waves, you know. Mm. They tend to spiral out and in, which is to say that, you know, whether it withers and wanes for a moment, even if that moment feels for, like, forever, it won't be forever. I think that what it will do is it will shift how people think and how people approach government and how they, what they come to expect from the government, and also how they come to expect they can, you know, demand or ask for change from their governments. You know, if we can agree upon the idea that reality is based upon agreement, you could look at today and say, wow, you know, a lot of people are starting to change their minds. A lot of people are starting to think, yeah, okay, like, for example, Americans may think, okay, I live in one of the richest nations in the world, and why is it so hard for my kid to get an education or health care? And yeah, capitalism, American dream, win, win, win. But why aren't the citizens, like, it should be guaranteed that the citizens, you know, are born winners in the game, just be a mere formality, you know? So I think that more people are kind of waking up to the possibility of the idea of a government that you know, looks out for its citizens and doesn't only free them to, you know, survival of the fittest, but also looks out for them, that guarantees some things that we've deemed to be important or inalienable, you know. And perhaps, you know, less people agreed upon these things in the past and more people agree upon them now. And if more people agree upon them now, maybe it takes the point of becoming reality. You know? So I think the effect will hold and will come. I think it's going to have a huge effect on us. But how it comes about, whether we go through a phase where, like, oh, that was for nothing, or what have you, I have no idea. You know, because at the same time that all these things are happening, you have lots of energy working towards manipulating what's happening, shifting what's happening into votes and into, you know, all sorts of things, you know. So we'll see. But I'm a firm, you know, observer. And I'm saying observer instead of the word believer. I'm a firm observer of the fact that, you know, the truth prevails. That, you know, the people win, that they do get it. But, it oftentimes comes at a cost. So who knows? Who knows what that will mean?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing you can see from all this disruption and protesting going on around the world is people are really looking at this from a perspective that government care about them. And if enough people show that they're not happy with this relationship we've got with the government, then the government will go, okay, we understand. Right, no problem. Here's what we're going to do. When do you think people will realize that every single one of us in society, we're just a name? We're just a number, literally a number. And that's it. That's all we are to the government. That's all we are. So I'm very interested to see what's going to happen next. I'm very interested to see what's going to happen next and how the government will respond to all those numbers saying, hang on a minute, we want this, we want that, we want this fairness.
Well, that's the thing, if we are just a number, if we pool our resources, we become a larger number, you know, and that's what governments respond to, is, you know, when that number of people hit the streets, that's when, you know, the president says, okay, I think I should resign. Or the, you know, the president of this corporation says, okay, looks like, you know, just for the sake of the stock in the company, because of public perception, you know. Public perception is a lot. You look at Apple and Steve Jobs. People look at, you know, Steve Jobs getting sick months ago, you know, and Apple stock falls from public perception, you know. So, you know, yes, we can maintain the idea that we're just a number, but together we represent a collective number that can call about and bring about the change that we desire. You know, that's why the numbers out there are so essential. Look at the shift in media, you know, that happened like in the States, for example, with the Occupy movement, and how, you know, they're like, oh, nobody's out there. And then when it started popping up everywhere, you know, it was almost like the media wanted to act like they were on the side of Occupy the entire time.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I remember at first they were hardly reporting on it for the first, like, 3 weeks.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Speaking to yourself, Saul Williams, and on our last show as well, there were some topics like this where, like you say, if all those numbers, if we are irrelevant, if we look at it from that perspective, we can all come together and we can actually hit the government where it hurts, and they do have to make a change. This is what it's about. If we all decided to, every single one of us, to say no, We're not going to do this. We're not going to pay taxes. We're not going to do this. And I'm taking this idea from a long interview we had very recently with Cannabis, who came up on the show, and he presented that idea, that exact idea I've just said there. That was his idea. That's what needs to happen for there to be change, was his response. And that's what he said. We all need to come together. It's amazing. That was about 8 months or 9, 10 months ago we did that interview. And now it is slowly, slowly happening. It's becoming a reality. That suggestion from Cannabis now is slowly becoming a reality. And I think more and more numbers are starting to refuse, and I think that's where it's starting to really hit the government a little bit now. But it's going to take time.
I would only make a few shifts in that statement, which is to say that, like you talk about me as the bedroom philosopher. I know that in philosophy, there's an idea of stating a hypothesis or proposition via negativa, meaning, through the negative, saying, no, I am not that, I am not that, and defining oneself through what one is not. But I would say that, the power of today and of our collected numbers would not be in us coming together and saying no, but in us coming together and determining what we can say yes to. And maybe that's just a play on words, but I think within that is also a shift in approach that is perhaps more realistic. I think there might be more people willing to say yes than say no. Because, pessimism and optimism are strange things, but at the end of the day, people want to start their days off on a good note. They want to feel like, okay, what they're doing matters, and that it adds up to something. And if we are to look at, the amazing leaders like the Mahatma Gandhis and the Martin Luther Kings and the Malcolm X's and all these things, sometimes, the most major shifts they made was when they made that slight shift in bringing people together on a yes principle.
How do you feel about Russell Simmons and Jay-Z's involvement in the Occupy movement?
Well, as far as Russell Simmons is concerned, I think that, I really think that his heart is in the right place. And I don't think that it's right necessarily to come down on the rich simply for being rich. Whether his heart is in the right place or not doesn't necessarily mean, the beautiful thing about the movement is that, there's no so-called leader of the movement, And so, he has every right to be interested and to listen and to read and to say, to hashtag Occupy. When you type something, I'm all for it, that's fine. Overall, that's fine, whether people choose to I had a thing one day when I read about the U.S. deciding to take funding away from UNESCO because of the vote for Palestine in UNESCO. I remember sending a tweet to Russell Simmons saying, hey, the U.S. is taking away $60 million, in funding from UNESCO because of this. Maybe this would be a great time for you and, your friends who have money like you do to cover that for the U.S. and to make a statement with that. And so people like him, it's not always a matter of them having to give money or what have you, but I think someone like him could be interesting and useful in creating the change that we foresee and desire. We need people, with money to stand with us, And as far as Jay-Z is concerned, as Jay-Z has matured as a rapper and artist with time, it's not always that I've agreed with stuff that he said in songs. For example, stuff like, I couldn't help the poor if I was one of them. When I think of political leaders, I don't think that they were successful because they had more money than the people that they were fighting for. I don't think money was that principle. But on the other hand, I really think that he's matured. I like how Jay-Z is maturing. I like the idea of Jay-Z becoming a father. I like the idea of Jay-Z being interested in, common everyday people, beyond the boundaries of Marcy Projects or Brooklyn. You know, I like the idea of him thinking of those things. The idea of him selling T-shirts or what have you, you know, well, that's if that's how he thinks, that's how he thinks. You know, it is what it is, you know,
right,
in those regards. But at the end of the day, I would also welcome. I think that, you know, a movement has to be inclusive. And so if we have, you know, if we disagree with that, then we just say we disagree with that. And then we point them in the right direction. We say, print this on a T-shirt. You know, print something that doesn't just take advantage of the situation, but print something that encourages the situation even more, you know. And so, you know, it's like, oh, you know, we could respond to that not by just slapping him on the hand. We could respond to the saying, oh, are you opening up your silk screening presses to us? Can you speak to the people behind the Occupy movement and see what we'd like to see, and emblazoned on T-shirts? Will you print some stuff for us, please? You know, we can communicate like that. So it doesn't have to be rejecting. So when you ask me of those two in either case, I would say, I would never reject them. I don't know Jay-Z personally. I do know Russell Simmons. And at the end of the day, like I said, I think both of them, I think their heart's in the right place. I think they, you know, they have been exposed to poverty. They both have come from poverty. And they know that they're lucky. They know that they're lucky to be in the position that they are. And I think that if, you know, points in the right direction, I think either one of them could make a helpful choice, helpful for the 99%, you know, which should have be more than just creating, you know, like, I don't know, credit cards for poor people or something, you know, more. But who knows? You know, we need thinkers to collaborate with those people as opposed to people to knock them down.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, how do you feel about the thought that these T-shirts, this current Rockaway line of T-shirts, occupy all streets? They could be potentially being made in third world countries. I mean, how do you feel about that thought? I mean, how would you address that to Jay personally, if you had the chance?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, in terms of all that, once again, It's my same response, you know. It's sometimes it's just a matter of making someone aware of it and communicating, you know. When I think of someone like Jay-Z, I don't think I need to stand outside of his office with a sign. I'd rather go to his office and say, hey, can we talk? Hey, have you ever thought about this? How can we do this different? You know, like, maybe you can do this. Maybe you can build a shirt factory. You know, like, whatever that is. I think that the proper response with someone like them is that I feel like we could actually talk to them. You know, I don't know who that we is or who that somebody is. Maybe it's me. I have no idea. You know, like, it's happened to me before. Like, I remember I ended up having a talk with Kanye West and Hype Williams about Diamonds. The name of that Kanye West song, Diamonds Are From Sierra Leone.
Right.
Before he had read about a treatment of a documentary my friend and I were working on about diamond mines in Sierra Leone, before that, the name of his song was Diamonds Are Forever. And he read the treatment to this documentary, and he asked a few questions, and before you knew it, the name of the song was changed from Diamonds Are Forever to Diamonds Are From Sierra Leone.
So,
and all it took was a conversation. But if you changed the name of the title, the Diamonds Are From Sierra Leone, which then, you know, made a lot of people realize, it was because he had just thought about that and changed it in the spur of the moment. And, you know, that's the thing, is that a lot of the shift and changes that we want can come from dialogue. So we need to open the stage and the floor to dialogue and find ways to do more than, you know, throw stones or what have you, but to really just be like, yo, you ever thought about this? You know, because I'm sure he can say stuff to me too, like, yo, have you ever thought about this type of account for your money? I'd use some financial advice from Jay-Z. I'd rather exchange information.
Indeed. Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Which is to say that I think there's a lot of things that he understands and he knows, or Russell Simmons understands that he knows, but perhaps I don't, you know? And it's not that I want to learn how to manipulate her or what have you, but I'd rather respect them as individual and say, you know, at least I try first with words. Then after that, you know, we can bring in the soldiers. But we try first with words.
Right. Absolutely. Now, culturally, you've seen the evolution of culture, you know, especially hip-hop culture and its elements all around the world, from New York to LA, Paris, and beyond that on tour. I mean, I like to look at this current Occupy movement that's taking place across the world right now as being similar to the urban, you know, spirit that was going on back in the day with graffiti writers having, you know, to go through these urban conditions of America in the 70s. I think that between the hardships and pain, this tight-knit family-based collective is being birthed out of the ashes to form what we know as Occupy Movement. Do you think that in these coming months and in 2012, we're going to see graffiti as an art form being used a lot more to express revolt against economic injustices and social inequalities?
Oh, certainly. I think in terms of what this movement does, you know, and you say, you know, like you remember the days of graffiti spreading. I remember the days of watching rap and hip hop spread, you know, and I've also have personally witnessed seeing, you know, poetry and spoken word and slam poetry spread across the world in the same way that this movement is spreading, you know, and have been able to witness it in different countries and around the world. But the thing about all of those movements is they inspire other people to participate and to realize that they have the power and the skill and the talent to participate. And I would say that in 2012, yeah, you're going to see a lot of street art, a lot of graffiti. You're going to hear a lot of songs, a lot of poems. And you know, soon after we'll start seeing movies and all this sort of things that reflect what's happening right now. Yeah, they all kind of spiral out from that. So it's a huge spark of inspiration, you know, and it really sparks young people thinking about, you know, well, why should they participate? What does this mean? It's in that way, it's very necessary, because it's certainly going to inspire, you know. The response would be immense. I remember when I was making my film Slam, you know, I was thinking very seriously about how many people could see the film and how many people I wanted to walk away from the film thinking that and feeling that they had the power within them to try to voice, you know, the change that they want to be and that they want to see. I wanted to see people, you know, leaving the theater and like, you know, deciding to write in a journal and voicing their ideas and these things. And you know what? I feel like I've seen that.
I'm one of those people. That film influenced me. Very influential in my life, man.
Wow. Yeah.
Very influential. Now, I want to ask you a question off topic with relation to your art and yourself. I mean, have you ever, as a recording artist, ever contemplated exploring the choices of expressing yourself as a fictional persona and creating a conceptual album based on that persona and not a direct reflection of Saul himself?
Certainly, I've done that more than once. For instance, this is Conspiracy Radio. You might enjoy this story. When I was doing my second album, which is self-titled Saul Williams, before it had that title, I was thinking that I was just going to have a band name and no longer use my name at all. And kind of do like Trent Reznor did with Nine Inch Nails, you know, and just give the illusion of a band, but it's really just me doing stuff. And I even came up with the name, and I trademarked the name before I decided not to use it. That name is the government.
Wow.
Because what's funny about the government is that in the government, it's all the Department of, the Federal Bureau of, you know, nothing in the government is called the government. So I actually had my lawyer trademark the government. And for 7 years, you know, I've owned the government.
No way. You trademarked. Wow. I mean, did you catch any flack for that? Wow, that's
no.
That's, wow.
So no, I didn't catch any flack. I did consider it a huge oversight on their part, you know. But like I said, nothing in the government is called the government. It's called the Federal Bureau of, the Department of, but nothing's called that. That's just what we call it. Mm. And so it's possible for me to trademark that name. So I thought about that, and then with Guitar Dust, you know, I skated between whether I was going to be, you know, like the Saul Williams Presents, or just do Guitar Dust as Guitar Dust with no reference to myself, but it seemed impossible to do that. But yeah, I play around with that a lot. And the idea of conceptual art and conceptual albums and characters and all that are really fun to me, you know, because I think the imagination is so important to how you connect with music and ideas and stories. It's it's super important and fun as an artist to create behind, you know, a cloak. Of course, sometimes it could be seen as hiding, but other times it can, you know, it can be a freeing sort of device, you know.
Right. Mm.
Excellent. Now, speaking of fun, of course, it's about making fun for your audience, and hoping more and more people relate to your idea of fun as you've done throughout your career. We've got quite a few listener questions with people aware that you were coming up onto the station. So if we can just run through some of these. Now, one of the predominant questions is about then future collaborations. Now, a lot of people know you from your work with some of the artists which, you know, are on rotation on different music channels, etc. What about you just in general then, what collaborations can your fans expect from Saul Williams? Who will you be partnering yourself with then over the forthcoming few months or maybe years to actually make projects and make tracks together then?
Honestly, I have no idea. You know, I really love collaboration. You know, on the other hand, usually when it happens, it's, you know, I meet like mind and it's immediate, like, yeah, let's do this. You know, it's not a lot of like planning and scheming. It usually just kind of happens. That's how I've collaborated with people like Zach or Janelle Monáe or Trent even. You know, it kind of just happens and there's a natural connection. So I'm open to a lot. You know, there are tons of people that I would love to collaborate with, from like a Flying Lotus to a Ganja Sufi to a PJ Harvey to a Patti Smith. You know what I'm saying? There are tons of people I'd love to collaborate with, producers and singers and what have you. But I have no idea who I'm going to encounter and what sort of, you know, things are going to come from those encounters. So I can't really say.
All right. Well, that's something to see in the future then, and something else we can look forward to and see what happens there. Another question, this is from one listener in Baltimore. How do you feel about hip-hop today? Who is Saul listening to? Asked the listener.
There's a lot of kids maybe it's not a lot of people I listen to. I'll tell you who I've listened to most recently that I enjoy. I do like the Carter Four. I listen to Lil Wayne's album. And I feel the difference in it. I feel like it's written. Maybe it's because he was in prison, and I can imagine that, you know, you have a lot of time to write when you're in solitary confinement or what have you. I feel like it was written. I felt the difference in nuance, in verse, and it's clever and fun. And I'm always a fan of how Wayne plays over beats. You know, like me personally, I'm like a big fan of the blues. You know, because to me, it's not really, once again, it's not really what people are saying. I'm more interested in how they're saying it, you know, and how it falls and rides over the beat. And I'm a fan of how Wayne plays with beats, lyrically. I don't mean in what he's saying, but vocally, I mean. Then someone like Lil B is actually funny to me. I enjoy it.
Exactly. No, I don't.
That's surprising. That's surprising, so. Why Lil B?
Oh, really? Because I feel it. Me, you know, I recognize passion when I see it, you know. And there's something, you know, there's something passionate there. I feel it. I felt it from his album, from a lot of the mixtape stuff, you know. Like, it's funny, it's silly, but then it's, There's a crescendo thing, like it's building. I feel it. Mm. I like it.
I was going to say there, don't feel that you come to a show where we're going to go, oh, okay, so let's move quickly away from that topic of Lil B collaborations. We're not going to do that. I love Lil B. I really do. I seriously, seriously do. And I know there's a nation of people a lot go, how can you possibly do that? How can you go from interviewing Saul Williams to admit that you like Lil B? To me, it's one and the same. It's pure creativity, and I love it.
No, to me, it's pure creativity. To me, it's, you know, I'm also a fan of, you know, like, for me, it's all about the polyrhythmic swag, you know? Mm. And so, like, they hear the beat going one way, and they hear that swag sweat or just hear how I'm listening to that. That's what I'm listening for in songs anyway. Like, people be very disappointed, I think, to learn that I'm not home listening to, you know, Common and Mos Def or some, you know, some sort of like, oh, this is really conscious. I really like what you're saying about, you know, like me, I'm more interested in like Project Pat and Gangsta Boo and how, you know, like,
yes.
Primarily because of, like I said, the blues. And to me, the thing about Southern hip-hop, for example, I know Lil B is from the West Coast, but I mean, the thing about Southern hip-hop, a lot of people, New Yorkers like myself, could get caught up and say, yeah, but what are they saying? I'm like, no, what they're saying is how they're saying. Robert Johnson played the same blues guitar as everybody else, but he played with his back to the audience because it wasn't what he was playing, it was how he was playing, you know? It's how he bent the words and bent the strings. You know, and that's what I like a lot of times is that playfulness, that playful musicality is what I enjoy in lyricism a lot of times and vocal expression. And Lil B has that. And then, like I said, I feel that passion. No, I'm into it. I don't want to make it a commercial and shit, but yeah, that's what I enjoy that. But then I can also listen to, you know, something like Death Grips. I really like Death Grips as well. You know, that song Full Moon and that video for Full Moon had me riding for a second. People like Bus Driver are always fun for me. And occasionally, you know, any MC has the capacity to touch me, whether it's a Jay-Z, a Kanye, a Tyler, the Creator, whatever, you know, like there's moments. I hear those moments when they strike them. And I'm like, oh, that's for everybody. I feel it when it comes. And yeah, I'm all for it. I don't really discriminate in those regards through underground, overground, conscious, unconscious. I'm just looking for that feeling.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Too many people don't look at hip hop these days as a collage, and that's exactly what it is and what it should be. That's exactly what
it's mixed media, man. It's
right,
mixed media.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's interesting you should say you're a fan of Gangsta Boo, because we were talking to her just last week on a show, and you actually have a common interest in the group U2, having sampled U2 yourself. She wants to do a song with U2, which I thought was interesting. Gangsta Boo,
yeah,
U2.
Memphis, stand up.
Why you laugh? Yeah, but no, she's serious. No, she was serious, very serious, and so were we when we asked it. But you know, that's
I know Gangsta Blue. I know Gangsta.
Yeah,
Blue.
She was a great
guest. Wonderful.
She was, yeah, because there's no boundaries in her world. There's creativity, like we've just been talking about. And she's,
exactly.
Yeah, I want to collaborate with you two. I'd like to make it happen. And like you said, the closed-minded say what, but I'm sure if you two found out. It could be a possibility. Imagine if it did happen. Imagine U2 and Gangsta Boo. It'd be genius. I think two different types of genius, but both together on a track. It'd be brilliant.
U2 might need that.
True.
Hey,
if Jay-Z's doing tracks with Coldplay, why not Gangsta Boo and U2?
Exactly. Right, another listener question then. What is the name of your next movie, or the next movie you'll be directing? Who are the actors involved, etc., says one listener.
Okay, well, the next movie that I'm in is not directed by me. It's directed by Alain Wamis. And that's he's a French director. And the name of the film is Aujourd'hui, which in French means today. And I shot it this summer. I was in Senegal for 2 months, shooting in Senegal. And it's the story of it takes place in a fictitious village in Africa where the dead come and choose one person to take back the land of the dead with them. And when they do, there's the community they come from wins a bunch of modern-day amenities, and the family, you know, wins a house and free education, all this stuff. Basically, it's the last 24 hours in the life of this man who is the chosen. And so from the moment he opens his eyes on that morning and finds out what's going to happen, and the moment he closes his eyes for the final time, I play that guy. And like I said, it's Aujourd'hui. And it has, there's a French Rwandan actress by the name of Anisia Uzine, who plays my wife in the film. There's a Malian, as in Mali, and French actress by the name of, Issa Maiga, who's also in the film Balto, who's in the film. There's a bunch of actors, primarily from France and the African diaspora, that are in the film. And it'll be out in 2012, next year.
Mm. All right, excellent. That's great news then for all the people who were asking about films and that sort of thing for us to address. Somebody's asking about Rick Rubin. It's Rick Rubin produced your first album and apparently didn't like your direction. Ask about that, says the listener, says Jay in Sweden.
Yeah. I'm the one who leaked that information. Yeah, he told me. Rick is a person who's very direct. He told me, you know, I don't understand it. You know, Rick taught me a lot. When I first signed with Rick, I'd already released a book of poetry, and I remember one day we were walking through Central Park, and he had my book of poetry, and he handed me the Beatles White Album, and he's like, "Saul, you're a writer. This is songwriting. Learn to dance." And I remember a few weeks later, like, we're in his car, and I was like, "Listen to this," and I put on a Jeff Buckley song. I said, "Do you like a Jeff Buckley?" And he was like, "I love his voice. I don't like his song arrangements." At that point, where I was, I couldn't pass his voice. So when he said, "I don't like his song arrangements," I know what the hell he's talking about. I was like, but his voice, you know. And over the years, I've been learning a lot about song arrangements. What Rick Rubin, you know, found difficult in my first album were the arrangements for some like coded language where there's no chorus, and, you know, speaking, you know, just straight through it, and that's what he was trying to instill in me, and I was rebelling against. And maybe that's why that album, because at this time I've learned to like the album more and more, you know. And but yeah, he wanted me to have better song arrangements, and me, I was just like, "Mom, dude, I gotta do what I feel." And he was nice enough to let me do that and to release it. So much, you know, thanks and gratitude to Rick Rubin, because a lot of people, and, you know, he was a producer and my label head, and he would have easily been like, "Well, then, you know, we're not recording anymore and it's not coming out." Instead, he let me have my way, and he released it. So, my gratitude to Rick Rubin.
Absolutely. No, I'm just absorbing in what you're saying there. I mean, to have that relationship is one thing, but to have that kind of critical relationship as well with somebody like that is astonishing. Listener also says that, also ask him, apparently Rick had never heard of De La Soul before working with yourself. Is that true?
He had heard of them, but he had never listened. I was trying a lot of, when I first started working on Memphis Roster, I was trying a lot of different like styles of, like, at that time, for instance, I was a big fan, let's say, of Gangstar. And so, like, I remember doing the song Penny for a Thought, and I was trying to deliver in a more casual, like, demeanor, like Guru would do. And he was, and Rick, you know, he had produced, the first person he produced was LL Cool J, who screams over music, you know? And Rick was actually like, "Nah, you need more energy." And I was like, "Nah, I want to be casual." He's like, "Why would you want to be casual?" I was like, "Have you ever listened to Gangstar?" He's like, "No." I was like, "You have to listen to Gangstar?" So I would play in Gangstar. I would play in people. I remember I went to his house. Yeah, one day I went to his house and I made him 3 feet high and rising. They lost his dead for the first time. He had never listened to it. He knew about the buzz and the sales and their numbers and the popularity. He had never listened, and he didn't understand necessarily why, you know, my generation, what have you, was responding to what they were doing and what were responding to. You know, so I would try to explain those things to him, you know, and then the other artists, like, you know, like, the other stuff he had to listen to, he was Bob Marley. He was like, "Oh, I've never really listened to Bob Marley." It's like, dude, I think maybe he thought it was too cliche, it was too punk. So it was like, "Now, today you're going to listen to Bob Marley."
Yeah. Yeah, true character. Listen, Saul Williams, been an absolute pleasure once again for this epic interview throughout this evening.
Well, thank you for the wonderful questions and thought-provoking questions. You know, it's honestly been a pleasure to talk to you just because, you know, you got it right. I appreciate, you know, intriguing conversation, and I'm not really intrigued myself, but at least, you know, you prodded me to, like, actually think about a few things. So thank you.
That means a lot, Saul. That means a lot, man. Coming from you, bro. It's been an
thank
honor.
And thank you to everybody listening, and I hope you guys are enjoying your day. So
listen, Saul, God bless. Take care of yourself. Wish you all the success with this album, the live shows, and everything else that's going to come in the future, the movies, the directing, the acting, everything. Take care. God bless. We'll speak to you again soon.
All right. Peace.
Peace.
Conspiracy Worldwide Radio, conspiracyworldwide@gmail.com.